Sound check and video check. We're going to get going in about 1 minute here. So you should be able to see and hear me. And you should be able to see the first PowerPoint slide. Hey, Danny, can you just confirm you're doing the recording, right? I don't have to do that? Yeah, it looks like it's going already. Okay, never mind. Okay. So we'll probably have IT issues since I was playing music from Pandora on something that we're charging money for. Okay, I've got the appropriate time now on my end, so why don't we go ahead and get going. If you want to have this PowerPoint local, then it was in the email that Danny sent out, so check your inbox if you didn't already see that, if you want to have this PowerPoint local. Okay, welcome everybody. This is the second lecture of the Mises Academy, Austrian Economics 1, Praxeology through Price Theory. And we're going to be finishing the material that comes from Chapter 1 of Rothbard's textbook tonight. So as you see, we got a lot of stuff to cover. So let's jump right into it. One thing I just want to mention, you may have seen I sent out a quick email blast about an hour ago. A few of you had mentioned that there was a problem on page 30 of the diagram of, I think it was figure 4. So that was correct. I agree there was a problem, and I've sent that on. Just in case, you know, for those of you who are interested in inside baseball, what happens is if you think you found a mistake in the text, you know, in Man, Economy, and State, or in my study guide for that matter, let me know, and then I'll look at it. If it's my study guide, then I'm the one who makes the call. But if it's with Rothbard, where the process is, you know, you think you found a mistake, I'll look at it. If I agree with you, I send it on to Joe Salerno, and if he agrees, then, you know, it goes through. Now, what we might do is if it's something particularly subtle, you know, he might ask other people just, you know, before we make some kind of change. But for something like this where it looks like it's just a mistake in the diagram, if Joe and I both, you know, I just have to convince him, and then he's the one who makes the call and the change. So we're sort of like medieval monks coming across transcription errors in the Gospels or something. Oh, my gosh, it's not that we're saying Jesus made a mistake. It's that we're saying some monk 200 years previously made a copying error. It's a similar thing here, actually. All joking aside, there are a lot of mistakes in various versions of the book, and it's what happens is it's not that necessarily that Rothbard made a silly mistake in his diagrams in the original manuscript. It's that when you go from one edition to the next, stuff gets screwed up because the people, you know, doing the grunt work of moving the diagrams over, you know, it's not like they put it under a photocopier. They have to nowadays, you know, do something with the software. I don't even know what format they store it in. But the point is sometimes stuff gets screwed up because they don't know. They just look at a diagram and see a line, and they don't, you know, oh, it goes down and then comes up, and they don't realize that, no, Rothbard drew in a very particular way that has to have certain properties. And so you have mistakes like that that creep in when you switch editions. So anyway, since the Mises Institute is now the keeper of the scholar's edition of Man, Economy, and State, if you see any mistakes, let me know, because that's the only way they're going to get weeded out. Okay, so back to tonight's lecture. Right away in the portion you were supposed to read for tonight, Rothbard makes almost an offhand remark about how value gets imputed from consumer goods to producer goods. And I don't think I touched on that in the first lecture of this course. And that's a pretty huge point. So let me just spend a few minutes on that. If you're curious, if you like the stuff I'm going to say for the next few minutes and you want to hear more, I went on at length on this stuff in response to a student question during the first office hours session. So if you didn't listen to that and you want to hear more about the contrast between the classical approach to value theory versus the subjectivist marginal approach, then you can go listen to that. If you really want to roll your sleeves up and get into it, you can look at my journal article that's in the Journal of Libertarian Studies, and I put it here on the slide, if you can see the URL. It's what it is, it's my critique of Kevin Carson's allegedly rehabilitated labor theory of value. Okay, so Kevin Carson, who is an anarchist, but like of a leftist variety, tried to rehabilitate the labor theory of value in light of modern subjectivist value theory. And I was not impressed by what he did, and so I went through. And there, if I may say so, I think that's the most succinct article you're going to find, just laying out major tenets of the classical cost or labor theory of value, and then the problems with it from an Austrian perspective, and how Menger and von Bawerk thought that the new subjective theory of value was an improvement. All right, so if you really are geeky and want to get into that stuff, you can read that article. But for our purposes tonight, let me just give you the big picture. So when we talk about the marginal revolution, and of those of you who know the blog run by Tyler Cowen and Alex Tabarrok, that's, you know, their name is riffing on this. So the marginal revolution refers to the early 1870s, when three economists are credited with independently discovering this. And so it's Carl Menger, William Stanley Jevons, and Leon Walras. And of course, Menger, the founder of the Austrian school, and then the other two guys are more associated with conventional mainstream neoclassical analysis, particularly Walras. So in broad strokes, the difference is before them, you know, if you have to pick a dividing line, before them is the classical period. So that's when the classical economists existed. And that includes Adam Smith, David Hume, David Ricardo, and Karl Marx, arguably. Okay, so I said this on Saturday, let me repeat it, that in terms of classifying economists in terms of their economic theory and their value theory, Karl Marx is a classical economist in the tradition of Adam Smith, right? So communism and Marxism didn't invent the labor theory of value. I mean, they applied it in certain ways and in terms of interpreting history, that kind of stuff. But as an economic doctrine, as a way that you explain market prices and so forth, the labor theory of value was not invented by Karl Marx. Right? It was invented by people that we nowadays consider to be basically free market. Right? So that's just kind of interesting. So just a few points, because I can't spend too much time on this. And the caveat I always give here is, when it comes to the history of thought in any discipline, but also in economics, it's a crude simplification to imagine that, oh, before the year 1870, economists all thought one way, and then Menger's book came out, or, you know, Jevons' book came out, and then boom, everyone thought a different way. That's not really accurate. Okay, but generalizing in terms of the frameworks that were popular and that people tended to use, there is a sharp distinction, and that the classical economists, the analytical framework that they use to explain market prices, and again, this isn't a straw man. I mean, go look at my article. Kevin Carson, to this day, uses this framework, right? He thinks it's workable and useful, whereas I don't think it is. Was to talk about the long-run tendency of prices in relationship to the cost of production. So if you wanted to understand, you know, why is it that a stagecoach tends to have a, you know, market value that's 10 times that of, a wicker chair, I'm trying to pick goods that would have been available back then the way David Ricardo might answer that is to say, well, it's because the costs of production are 10 times higher for the stagecoach than for the wicker chair. And so, you know, the price that the manufacturer gets for it has to at least cover his cost of production, because if the price were lower, then he'd be losing money with every stagecoach that he sold, and so he'd stop doing that. Why would he keep making stagecoaches if the price that he could get for them were less than what he had to spend on the factors to make it? All right, so okay. So that explains why the price has to be at least equal to the cost of production, at least in the long run. But then also, it couldn't be significantly higher, right? You couldn't have huge above normal profits being earned in Stagecoach production, because then other producers would look at that and say, well, gee, why don't we get into that? And so that would increase the supply, and that would push down the price. And people trying to buy more materials to make more stagecoaches would push up the prices of the scarce factors needed for stagecoach production. And so the gap between the, you know, the final, the consumer price, the retail price, and the cost of production would shrink that way. So the rate of profit would shrink. Okay? So that's the idea. Now, it's not, when we say cost of production, one of the things they might include would be the normal rate of profit. Okay, so technically they wouldn't be equal. There would be a gap to allow for a return on the invested capital. So you could either include that as an explicit cost, or you could say the price has to be sufficiently higher than the cost of production to allow for the capitalists to earn some kind of return, right? So depending on how you want to phrase that. All right, so that's the basic view. And, you know, that's not a stupid theory. I mean, if you didn't know anything, someone pointing out those things to you would be doing you a favor, right? You would understand patterns in the economy and relationships among various prices better having heard that little two-minute discourse I just went through compared to someone who just thought, oh, it's all about greed, or, oh, a producer can charge whatever he wants because he has market power, or something like that, right? So that is an advance to see that, oh, no, the retail price of something in the long run bears a very definite relationship to the cost of producing the product, okay? So it's not that that's wrong, but the point is that's a very superficial analysis, okay? And there's a few things wrong with it. So for one thing is that really doesn't explain the formation of market prices. All it's really doing is explaining the relationship between various market prices, because what we call the costs of production are themselves prices, right? So if you say, why is the price of a stagecoach such and such, and I'm ultimately explaining that because I'm saying, oh, well, the price of the wood is such and such, and the price of the workers to, you know, assemble the stagecoach is such and such per hour, and the price of the glue and the nails or whatever the heck you use to build a stagecoach is such and such, and that's why the retail price of a stagecoach has to be, you know, 50 grams of gold, and it can't be higher because then competition would come in. Well, I just pushed the problem back one step. Because then you say, well, okay, well, then why is the price of the lumber so many grams of gold per cord or whatever the unit of lumber is? I don't know. I don't go out and buy much lumber myself. Okay, so that's one thing that you're really not, you know, to switch it to a cost theory is really just pushing the problem back one step. And also, even on its own terms, it's not true that the retail price of a product is necessarily equal to, or that it always has the same relationship to, the cost of production, right? If there's a glut in stagecoach production, you know, the people who make stagecoaches, let's say for some reason they think there's going to be an adequate demand for it next year, and then all of a sudden Henry Ford comes out with his Model T, and the stagecoach manufacturers, they built up a bunch of, you know, a huge inventory, and now they're sitting on it, and they take it to market, and all of a sudden everyone says, nope, we're spending our money on Model Ts now. You know, the owner, the guy sitting on that inventory of stagecoaches, it's not, you know, he can't just say, well, no, I spent this much money producing these things, so you consumers darn well better give me this much money for them, otherwise I'll lose money. The consumers say, well, sucks to be you, right? Excuse me. Stinks to be you, right? This is a family-friendly course. Okay, so producers all the time have to sell below cost, right? If they make an entrepreneurial mistake, if they forecast the demand for their product incorrectly, right? So what Menger and Bombaverk and other Austrians point out is that, if what we're trying to do as economists is explain the formation of market prices, the cost theory of value gives you at best is just a long-run tendency. It doesn't really tell you day-to-day what makes the spot price what it is. okay? And so you would need an entirely different apparatus to explain that, and that's what the subjectivist marginalist theory gives you. So Menger and others are trying to explain not just the long-run tendency, they're trying to say, no, today, what is it that makes the price of the stagecoach what it is? And they can explain that, whereas the classical economists really can't. I mean, the classical, it's not that they were stupid. They they would understand, oh, well, yeah, he had to sell at below cost because the demand for his product collapsed. I mean, they would get that. But the point is, that would be sort of like a deviation from their theoretical framework. That would be like an exception to the rule, whereas Menger and Bumbavrick and so on, they were saying, no, let's start first and foremost explaining the price right now. That's what we should be doing, and then that same framework can also explain the long-run tendencies. Okay, so that's one major difference, and why it, I think, is an unambiguous improvement, that we're directly explaining the phenomenon, we're not just explaining some long-run pattern. Okay, then another difference, pretty fundamental difference, is that the cost or labor, let me just explain the difference between the cost and labor theory, and then I'll move on because I'm spending too much time on this. So if you get the idea of the cost theory, and then the labor theory of value is more particular, and that explains the little nagging problem I said a few minutes ago, where at best you're just pushing the problem back one step. Because what the labor theorist of value says is, yeah, you're right. If I say, oh, the reason the stagecoach costs 50 grams of gold is that the lumber costs this many grams and the hire the workers at this last step of the process costs so much, blah, 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 and that all adds up to 50 grams, or that all adds up to 47 grams and we need the remaining three to be interest on the invested money, you don't stop there. Then you push it back and you say, well, why is the lumber such and such grams for that much? And you can use the same process, and you can say, well, because the producer who's in charge of selling lumber to stagecoach producers, they can charge a price that needs to equal their long-run cost of production. And so what goes into making lumber for sale? And they say, oh, well, you have to, pay the owner of the forest for the rental price to be able to chop down his trees and haul them out. And you have to pay the workers to haul the trees out and to, pay the lumberjacks and all that kind of stuff. So you can just keep going back step by step in decomposing the cost of production with the various materials, but ultimately you're just going to keep butting up against workers who have to get paid. And so a stopping point for the classical economists who subscribe to the labor theory of value, is they said that's the one place where it makes sense, where the explanation can stop. Because there, when you say, well, why is it the worker has to get paid, they would say, well, because they don't like, labor is has this utility. You have to give the worker money to get him to get off his butt and do something for you. Whereas, you don't have to cajole nature into allowing you to cut down trees to turn them into stagecoaches. Right? So the thing that the constraint on that issue is just the getting the workers to be willing to get off their butts and pick up an axe and chop down the tree. Given that the tree exists and given that the axe exists, the thing that's the bottleneck in that operation is that you've got to get some workers to be willing to stop engaging in leisure and to start working for you. And so that's, so ultimately they would trace back the finished product prices for everything ultimately into the amount of total labor that went into it. And by total, I mean, going back in time and saying, well, how much labor was required to produce this thing and how much labor was required to produce that component and so on. Okay, so they're, so that's the relationship between why does a cost theory ultimately reduce to a labor theory of value, at least among certain classical economists. Okay, so there is a problem with that, by the way, that Bumbavrick points out, and I mention it in this article. It's not worth getting into, but there is a logical problem even there. It's not just that that's unhelpful; it's that that's just flat out wrong. What I just said, that's not right. That's not the way you can't actually do that. But it's not worth us getting into. So as far as what I launching off point for this tangent is Rothbard saying that, you know, in under modern subjectivist marginalist value theory, the causality, the way we understand the formation of prices as economists, is we say that consumers value the finished products, the consumer goods, according to their value scales and using the law of marginal utility, right? So as you consider successive units of a consumer good, you, you know, say, okay, well, the first unit's going to go to the most important end I can satisfy with it. And then if I have a second unit, what would I do with it? Well, I would devote it to the second most important end that can be satisfied with this particular type of good, and so on. So that's where the valuation of the finished consumer goods comes from. It comes from the consumer, and the consumer doesn't care how those goods were made. You could have found them in the forest, aliens could have given them to us, or you could have spent thousands of dollars producing them. That's all irrelevant as far as the consumer's valuation is concerned. And it's the consumer valuation, the marginal utility analysis, that explains how those finished retail prices are formed. But then you say, well, okay, well, how do we value the higher order goods, the factors of production needed to make those things? And that's where this chapter begins, or this section begins, part six, that you as a producer say, okay, I understand, you know, I know what the prices are for the consumer goods, and where do those prices come? They come from marginal utility, because those goods are directly serviceable for ends that my customers have. So now, as a producer, how do I value or appraise different factors of production, you know, steel and rubber and skilled laborers and stuff like that? Well, I have knowledge of technological recipes. I know that, or I believe, if I hire a bunch of skilled work, you know, if I hire this guy, this lumberjack, I look at his resume, and, oh, yeah, you've worked for other lumber companies. I know you're a reputable lumberjack, and I buy some axes from this guy over here, and I pay some money to a landowner to let me chop down trees, and I'm, you know, I have the legal right to haul the lumber off of his land, and I know that I can do all that, mix them together, and then produce lumber, and I know how much the stagecoach producer over here is willing to pay me for lumber. And that's the way I figure out how much should I be willing to pay for, you know, an hour of lumberjack services, and how much should I be willing to pay for an axe, and so on. Okay, so it's the causality runs the other way, that the value begins, the determination of value begins at the level of the consumer good. And that's why Menger, in his hierarchy, makes those the first order or the lowest order goods. And then it goes upward, that the second order goods are the things used to produce the consumer goods, and vice versa, or and so on, I should say. All right, so that is opposite of the labor theory of value, okay, that whether or not the classical economist actually said this, you know, sort of metaphysically or philosophically, certainly the labor or the cost theory of value puts in your mind the notion that value starts out in human beings and workers, and then it flows into the stuff they make. And so that the reason you, so that the reason that stagecoach has such a high market price is that look at all of the valuable labor hours that went into its production. And so there was this idea, again, whether they explicitly said this or not, but certainly the labor theory of value made it easy to think like this, that value resided in the factors of production and ultimately in human labor, and then it flowed into the stuff they made step by step, and then so depending on how many hours it took to make something, that's why that thing could command such a high price from consumers, okay, because the value went from the laborers into that thing. Okay, so you can see why that would be like an objective theory of value. So again, in total contrast to that, the modern subjectivist marginalist approach says, no, there's really no such thing as value that resides in objects. Value is something that is bestowed upon objects by a human mind. And so when you want to, from scratch, explain the prices we see in the marketplace, the place you start is you say the consumers have goals and desires, and consumer goods help them satisfy those things. And so that's how we explain the various prices of consumer goods according to marginal utility. And then the next step is, now that we understand that, logically now we can explain the prices of those factors that directly produce those consumer goods. And then once we know that, we can logically explain the prices of the third order goods, because we, you know, so you just go that way. So it's not chronologically that you can see the prices rippling out from the consumer goods. Obviously, anytime you open your eyes, the prices are already there. But the point is, logically speaking, the Austrian starts with the consumer goods and then works step by step back through the structure of production to the higher and higher orders of factors of production. Okay, so later, well, it won't actually be in this course. I think it would be in the second one, if you guys stick around for that. We'll go through an actual example, and you'll see this stuff with a numerical example. But I just right now want to give you the big picture philosophically, and you understand the huge methodological difference between the classical approach and what's called the subjectivist marginal approach. Okay, so I probably spent too much time on that, but that is an important issue, so let's move on. Okay, so the law of returns. Let me just perhaps reassure some of you, in the grand scheme, this kind of stuff, if you're getting tripped up on it, and this particular example is not too bad, but in certain portions of the book, Rothbard really gets his hands dirty with esoteric portions of what would be called production theory. And, you know, some of the examples get a little bit cumbersome with, you know, suppose there's this combination of factors and da-da-da. And if your head's starting to swim, you can kind of just breeze through that. You're not going to lack a fundamental understanding of Austrian economics if this stuff doesn't totally click with you. But, I mean, I'm not saying just skip it, but give it a shot. But if it's just not intuitive to you, it's not really that important, I don't think, at least if you're just trying to come away with a general understanding of the Austrian view. Okay, but having said that, let me just make sure I try to explain this. So what Rothbard is doing in this table, he's saying that there's two goods that combine to make the finished product. So there's factor X and factor Y. So the factor here means like factor of production. Okay, so factor X might be units of or hours of labor, and factor Y could be units of steel or something. Or maybe factor, if you're trying to grow crops, factor X might be pounds of fertilizer, and factor Y might be gallons of rainfall or something like that. Okay, so the idea is there's two things that are needed together to produce whatever the product is. And so what we're looking at is we're going to hold one of the factors constant. So we're going to say, like if we're saying it's growing crops, that maybe X is how much fertilizer we're adding, whereas Y is how many gallons of rainfall. So we're going to hold the rainfall constant. Like, so the 3 years, like, it's, you know, assuming we have just a fixed 3 gallons of rainfall, if I were to vary how much fertilizer I put in, what does that do to the total, you know, number of tomatoes that end up being created by this technological recipe? That's the idea. So we're only varying one of the inputs, and we want to see what effect does that variation in just one of the inputs have on the total amount of the finished product. Okay, that's the idea. So so that's why the threes are all the same down this first column. And the second column starts with 0 and then goes up through 7, because we want to see, if we just vary that one factor, what does that do to the total output? And so the total product here is the P units, and so that's, you know, the 0, 4, 10, 18, and so on. That's showing how many tomatoes get produced, let's say, to work with this example. OK, Okay, so as we increase the fertilizer from 0 units of fertilizer to 1 to 2 to 3, we have 0 tomatoes shoot out. And then if we have 1 unit of fertilizer with a constant 3 gallons of rainfall, now we get 4 tomatoes. If instead of that, we had put in 2 pounds of fertilizer with the same 3 gallons of rainfall, then we would have had 10 tomatoes and so on. Okay, so that's what this is doing. So these last two columns, now let me just explain what these are. So the average unit is saying it's just dividing the total by the amount of the factor that you're varying. Okay, so what it's showing is the average unit per unit of the variable input. Okay, so let me just explain some of these numbers so you see where they're coming from. So this first one, zero, that's because you're taking, I think that should probably be undefined as well, because you're dividing by zero there. All right, so actually, that may be a typo also. The reason Rofford put zero is because P is zero on that first row, but technically you're doing zero divided by zero, which is not zero, it's undefined. Okay, but the next row makes sense. So the next row, it's 4 divided by 1, so that's why Rofford put a 4 in there. The third row, again, we're looking at the fourth column, the third row, that number is a 5, and that's coming from 10 divided by 2. Then the next row is a 6, and that's 18 divided by 3, and so on. Okay? And then the marginal product is saying how much does total output go up when you increase the variable factor. Okay, so that's a different thing from saying what's the average product per unit of the variable factor. Here we're looking at on the margin, if you add one more unit of the variable factor, what does that do to the total? Okay, so the first row is undefined because you can't compare it to what happened if you had less. The first row is a 4, because what they're saying there is they're saying if you originally had 0 units of A, factor X, units of X, and then you added one more, output would jump from 0 to 4. Okay, so that's why we're saying the marginal product of the first unit of factor X is 4 tomatoes. Because if you originally had 0 units of factor X, and now we added 1, all of a sudden output jumps from 0 to 4. So the marginal physical product of that first unit of X, of the first pound of fertilizer in my example, is 4 tomatoes. Okay? And again, these numbers are all predicated on a certain fixed amount of all the other inputs. So 3 gallons of rainfall, for example. If we changed it to 4 gallons of rainfall, then these numbers might shift in the other columns too. Okay? So you always, with this kind of approach, you hold everything else constant, and then you just vary one of the inputs and look at what does that do to the total output, and then you can compute the average product and the marginal product. Okay, let me just do a couple more of the numbers to make sure you guys get the pattern. So the third row here, the marginal product is a 6. So what does that mean? That is saying the marginal product of the second pound of fertilizer is 6 tomatoes. And why is that? Because if you look under the total product column, going from 1 unit of fertilizer to 2 increases the total from 4 to 10. Okay, so 10 minus 4 is 6. So that's why the marginal physical product of that second pound of fertilizer is 6 tomatoes. Okay? Let me just do one more and make sure you guys see the pattern, then I'll move on to a different point. So now the fourth row, that marginal product number is 8, and that's because bumping it up from 2 units of X to 3 units of X increases output from 10 to 18. Okay, so this last column, the way you fill in these values is you look at the difference in the total product. As you move from one row to the next, how much does the total amount jump up that's the marginal product, and that's what's filling in the cells in the rightmost column, whereas under the average unit, what you're doing is dividing. You're saying what's the total for any given row divided by how many units of X are there, and that's what the average is. Okay, so Rothbard makes an observation. Let me just, it's pretty intuitive once you get what he's saying, but it's a little bit obscure the way he phrases it. He's saying if you look at the at these columns of average and marginal product, you'll see that, and I'm paraphrasing because I think the way I'm going to say it is more intuitive, for any given row, if the hang on, let me clarify one thing. I see in the questions, somebody says, hey, isn't there a typo? This last column, Rothbard put delta P divided by delta A. Isn't that a typo? Isn't it just delta P? And you guys probably all know this, but delta is the same thing as that triangular symbol that Rothbard has. That's the mathematical, it's the, what is it, the Greek letter delta, and that just means change in, okay? So delta P divided by delta A means change in P divided by the change in A. So no, to answer your question, that's not a typo, that's correct. It's a bit redundant in this particular example because delta A is always 1. So you're always dividing by 1. So it's correct. I mean, there's not a mistake in the formula. What happens is in some applications, you might not have the data specific enough to show you increasing X one unit at a time, right? So I might just have, be able to give you, instead of doing 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 in the second column, suppose I had given you 0, 10, 15, 32, 74, and so on, then you wouldn't be, the delta A would be bigger than 1, is what I'm getting at, okay? And so there, strictly speaking, you would be looking at the average marginal product over that range of units. Okay, so anyway, if I just lost you guys, don't worry, but I just wanted to address the question I saw in the chat box. Okay, so back to the special relationship between these last two columns. Rothbard points out, and again, I'm paraphrasing here to make it a little bit more intuitive. For a given row, if the marginal product on that row, meaning that unit of factor X, is higher than the average product is, then that means on the next unit, the that means it will have pulled up the average. Okay, so where the marginal product is higher than the average, that tends to pull the average up. And then going the other way, if the marginal product is lower than the average, then that tends to pull the average down as we keep going along. So, for example, look, in unit 1 here, where factor X is 1, the second row, the average is 4 and the marginal product is 4. Then going to 2 units, the marginal product jumps to 6, and so that's, so we know if you didn't have the actual raw information, if I just gave you this right-hand column and you saw that the average product was 4 and then, you know, I just had like blanks for you to fill in, the fact that you saw the marginal product on the third row went to 6, you would know that the average product had to be higher than 4 in the third row. You wouldn't know what it was if you didn't have the raw numbers at your disposal, but you would know, you could back it out. But the point is, if the marginal product is higher than what the previous average was for the row above, then the new average has to go up. And so that's just so you see that because 6 is bigger than 4, then the average unit product goes up to 5. And then looking at the fourth row, the marginal product is 8. Well, 8 is bigger than 5, and so you know the average product has to go up, and yep, it goes up from 5 to 6. And then the fifth row, the marginal product is 12. 12 is bigger than 6, so that means the average product has to go up, and yep, whoop, it went up to 7.5. The next row, now this gets interesting. The marginal product went down. It goes down from 12 to 10, But the average product still goes up because 10, even though it's less than 12, is still bigger than 7.5. And so that's why the 7.5 goes up to 8. But now, going down to the sixth unit or the seventh row, the marginal product drops down to 5. And 5 is less than 8, so that's why the average unit drops to 7.5. And then the last row, 4, is less than 7.5, and so that's why the average drops to 7. Okay, so there's a very easy way to remember this. Just imagine you're a kid taking a class, and you have, you know, tests every week, and so like the first week maybe you get a 100%, and then the next week you get an 80%. So after the second week, you ask yourself, what's my average in the class so far? Well, the first week I had 100%, the second week I had an 80%, so my average test grade right now is 90%. Then the third week, let's say you get a 95% on your third test. And then you wonder, oh, did that raise my average or pull it down? Now, one way to answer that is you could, you know, add up the three scores, the 100%, the 80%, and the 95%, get the total, and then divide by 3, see what that answer is, and then compare it to 90% and see, is this bigger or less than 90%? But rather than going through all that, immediately you know on any given week, if my test score for that week is bigger than my average was last week, then my new average is going to be pulled up. And on the other hand, if on any given week, if my test score for that week is lower than my average was, you know, going into it, then I'm going to pull down my average. Okay, so how much you pull it up or pull it down depends on how many weeks are under your belt. But the point is, if the marginal test on any new week is bigger, if the score you get is higher than your previous average, then your new average is going to go up. And if it's lower, then your new average is going to go down. Okay, so for some reason with my students, when I used to teach this in undergrad, that clicked with them in 2 seconds and they got that, whereas with examples of physical production, they sometimes couldn't see it. Okay, so that's all that's going on here with the relationship. So as far as the law of returns, what is Rockford getting at? Well, he's saying you can do this for any process of production, this kind of analysis, that you can fix all the other inputs and just vary one of the inputs and then compute, you know, look at the change in the output, the number of units of output of whatever the, you know, target good is or finished good is that you're making, and you can compute the average and the marginal products. And he's saying the law of returns says that if some finite level of input, of the amount of the input of that variable factor, in this case it's factor X, you're going to have a maximum average product. So in this particular numerical example, it occurs when you have 5 units of factor X. And the maximum average product is 8. And again, that 8's coming from the fact that with 5 units of X, you make 40 units of the finished product total. So 40 divided by 5 is 8 units. So on average, you're getting 8 units of the output from the factor of production. Okay? So let me just make 2 more points and then we'll move on. How can I put it? Okay. Rockford refers to that as the optimum amount of X. And I think that term is possibly misleading. Okay. That what we mean by optimum is that is the amount of X such that you're maximizing the yield per unit of X. Okay, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's the correct thing for the entrepreneur to do. Okay, so in general, it's not true that you're always going to want to produce using the so-called optimum number of inputs for a particular factor. Okay, I mean, that might end up happening under certain circumstances, but what I'm saying is there's no reason directly that a producer should say, my goal is to maximize the amount of output per unit of a variable input, that that's not necessarily the case. Okay. Another point, and then I'll move on, is Rothbard tries to justify the law of return. So he tries to explain why should we expect this to be true. And he thinks he can derive it from the action axiom. All right, so let me just briefly recapitulate his argument. So he's saying he does a proof by contradiction. Okay, so the way a proof by contradiction works, just in general, is you say, if I'm trying to prove that some statement or proposition is true, one way of doing it is I can say, suppose it weren't true. And then if that scenario leads to an absurdity, if it leads to something that we know can't be right, then we can say, well, that first statement must be true then, right? Because if assuming that it's not true generates an absurdity, then the thing must be true. Okay, so that's the form of the argument. And the way it works in this particular example is he says, if the law of returns weren't true, then it would mean we could continually increase the average unit of output per unit of the variable factor, right? Because remember, the law of returns says there is some optimum level, that it might increase over a certain range, but eventually it's going to top out. There's going to be a maximum. So what we're saying is this fourth column that starts at 0, then 4, 5, 6, 7.5, 8, and then it starts dropping again. Rothbard is saying, if you, for any good you give me, and I can construct something like this for any of the inputs, hold all the other factors constant and just vary one of the inputs, he's saying that, you know, the numbers in these columns will be different, but it has to be the case that for any permutation, anytime we run this experiment, there is going to be a maximum number in this fourth column. So in this example, it's 8, but he's saying there necessarily will be, it's not just going to keep increasing as we keep bumping up the number of the factor X. That's what he's saying. And he says the reason that has to be true, he said, suppose it weren't. Suppose you could show me some good where the recipe, the technological recipe, were such that we could indefinitely increase this fourth column. We could just keep increasing the average unit. And Robert says, well, if you think about it, that means we could produce as much of that finished product as we wanted if we just kept increasing this factor X. And so in principle, we could reduce the amount of the other factors that we were bumping into it, right? So, you know, we could divide everything by 3. And so we'd have factor Y would just be 1 across the board, and then factor X would cut everything in 3, and then the output would all get cut by thirds, right? And if we're just, like, focusing on 1/3 of the operation, but the proportions would still be the same. And so if the average product still kept going up, we could still do that. And so Rothbard was saying, you know, in principle, we could just scale down all the contributions of the other factors, and even though the total output would drop, we could compensate for that by sufficiently bumping up the factor X, because we're assuming as long as you add enough X, you can keep increasing the average unit per product of that input. Okay? So the point is that ultimately you could make as much of the finished product as you wanted just with factor X in the logic, in the extreme. And that doesn't make any sense, because Rothbard had earlier shown that the action axiom itself implies that every consumer good, to make it, you need the contribution of at least 2 distinct factors of production. Okay, and so that's, you know, I didn't dot every I and cross every T there, but that's the basic argument. So he's saying there has to be this physical maximum point whenever, for any good, that you drew up these charts as far as the average unit product. Okay, so let me move on here, because I spent a lot of time on that. Okay, next slide, specificity and convertibility. So the general law that Rothbard talks about here is, he says, a change in the value of the product causes a greater change in the value of the relatively specific factors than in the value of the relatively non-specific factors. So what he means here is all the factors of production, they combine in different ways to make certain products. But the specificity of a factor means the more specific a factor of production is, that means the narrower the range of consumer goods it can create physically. Okay, and so if you like raw lumber is less specific than a doghouse. Okay, that once you take materials and you use them to go further along a certain chain of production, they become more and more specific. All right, or if you take raw lumber and make an axe with it, you know, lumber and steel or whatever, lumber and iron, I don't know what the axe head's made out of nowadays, then the axe is far more specific than the lumber and the metal. Okay, because once you congeal them into an axe, you know, you can use the axe for a lot of different things, but you can use lumber and steel for a heck of a lot more. Okay, that's the idea. So what Rothbard is saying in this law is that if the consumer valuation of a particular good goes down, for example, that will ripple upward through the chain of production. Because remember, the value we assign to the factors is ultimately derived from the value that consumers assign to the consumer goods. So if the consumers change their valuation of those things that are the last goods along the chain of production, that stuff ripples up, but not uniformly. So the things that were very specific bear the brunt of the value drop, whereas the factors of production that are relatively non-specific, they can be shifted out of that and into other lines, and so their value doesn't drop as much. Okay, so Rothbard uses the example, if all of a sudden people gave up smoking, right, because you know the health concerns come out, and all of a sudden Americans, or if you're in whoever country you're in, everyone just stops smoking because they don't want to get lung cancer. Well, the vendors who have cartons of cigarettes in their inventory, you know, those things are going to drop to zero. Or maybe, you know, some collector might buy them just to, you know, have like as an exhibit to show his kids, hey, people used to smoke these things. Isn't that crazy? Okay, but clearly the value, the market value of those cartons of cigarettes is going to plummet. Farmers who have tobacco crops already planted, you know, the value of those crops is going to plummet because no one's going to need them for anything. But the market value of the real estate, of the actual farmland, isn't going to drop to zero because they can just replant. They can plant corn or something, right? Because the land itself can be diverted to something else. It's less specific than a carton of cigarettes. A carton of cigarettes isn't useful for very much except to be sold in individual cigarette packages to consumers who want to smoke. Okay, so that's why if all of a sudden everybody decides to stop smoking, that change in the final consumer valuation is going to have effects on the prices of the factors of production, but it's going to just crush the prices of those things that were really tied into smoking, where the factors that were used in the production of cigarettes but can be easily converted to something else, those things aren't going to see their prices crash nearly as much. They'll go down a little bit, but not as much as the stuff that's more specific. That's the idea. Okay, next slide. We're going to talk a little bit about labor here. So one thing is Rothbard says, he explains that leisure is a consumer good. So in terms of the economic analysis, the only way to really make a satisfactory explanation of the prices of various consumer goods and factors of production and so on, when it interacts with labor markets, what economists typically do is they treat leisure as its own consumer good that, in effect, workers buy. Okay, and it's, I think we'll get into, I'm not sure if we get into it in this class. It might be in the next one. But especially for those of you who are, if you go on to take intermediate micro at the college level, like if you're an economics major, you might get into this where you explicitly draw supply and demand curves in the labor market and so on. And the way you model it is that, you know, a consumer has a certain amount of money, has a budget constraint, has income, and then they spend it in different ways. And one way you can model it is to say you can spend it buying leisure. And what that means is you don't work as much. Okay, so you, in theory, could work 24 hours a day. Let's say you make $10 an hour at your job, and forget about labor laws and stuff like that. So in theory, you could earn $240 a day, right? 24 hours times $10 per hour. But if you only actually work 8 hours a day, you know, one way of modeling that is to say that you took your $240 and you spent $160 buying 16 hours of leisure, right? Because you only actually worked 8 hours, right? So that's one way of looking at it, okay? So that's kind of where Rothbard's coming from here, where he says the way we analyze it is we assume that leisure is a consumer good. And he points out in footnote 27 that this is the first instance in this particular chapter, chapter 1, where Rothbard has to rely on more than the action axiom. Okay, so everything that he's done up to this point in the chapter, he claims he can deduce from the fact that people act per se. Okay, so it's true, he uses familiar everyday examples like a ham sandwich and people losing the valuation of cigars and stuff like that just to make it relevant for the reader. But the point is the actual laws and things like that and principles that he was deducing don't depend on the empirical realities of human life. All they depend on is the fact of action and everything that action implies logically. But this point, that we're going to treat leisure as a consumer good, that does not flow from the action axiom itself, according to Mises and Rothbard. Okay, so I just want to clarify what they're saying. Another way of interpreting the claim that leisure is a consumer good is to say that labor carries disutility, meaning other things equal, people would prefer not to work. All right, so that's kind of what it means. So to be honest with you, I mean, I don't want to get too philosophical here. If you're having trouble with this, if you're an advanced student and it seems to you like something's fishy here, I sympathize with you because I, in other contexts, and if I had an infinite amount of time, I would write a paper on this. I think you could handle the analysis of labor markets praxeologically. I don't think you need to bring this in because I think if what we mean by leisure, because remember, leisure doesn't mean just lounging around. Leisure means when you're using your body's power for things that are directly pleasurable to you, not as a means to an end. Because to engage in labor is to use your body's productive powers to produce something that you then desire. So look, it's an indirect use. So I think praxeologically you could say that by definition labor carries disutility because what that means is you're doing something that you don't directly desire or that is not first among the things you would want to be doing. You're doing it only because of the indirect satisfactions that it brings. So it would seem to me like, by definition, you would rather do something that directly satisfies your ends rather than something that only indirectly does. So anyway, but for whatever reason, I mean, Mises and Rothbard, of course, are what they're getting at, why they put this in here, why they treat it this way, is they're trying to say, look, with every other good, people use the maximum number of units so long as the marginal product is still positive. Okay, so if I'm trying to think. they would say there's nothing really analogous when it comes to like using barrels of oil or something. When we're trying to figure out, we have deposits of oil, and how much are we pumping today, and how much are we leaving in the ground? Those decisions, the producers make those decisions based purely on maximizing revenue. That, you know, if you, the reason we don't pump every last barrel of oil that's physically available today is that the, you know, the price today would drop too low as the quantity available increased, and then the price next year, when all the oil was gone, would be through the roof. So producers say, well, wait a minute, I'm going to scale back how much we pump today, keep some of it in the ground so that I can sell some barrels next year, right? And that's what they're doing. Okay, so the reason they're withholding the supply of oil, if that's the way you want to think about it, is just because they want to sell some of it in the future. There's no question that eventually they're going to sell all the oil, or more specifically, more accurately, they will continue to sell barrels of oil so long as the extraction costs are lower than the price they can get for it, okay? But whereas with labor, that's not what goes on. People don't allocate their available hours of body power solely by monetary considerations. You don't, you know, you may not work more on a particular day, not simply because you want to rejuvenate your productive power so you can work more the next day, right? Most people empirically work far less than that if they're not slaves and they have a choice. Okay, so that's what Mises and Rothbard are getting at here, is they're going to say, in contrast to all other goods, the owner of labor power typically brings to market far fewer units than would be physically possible if all we cared about were maximizing the income accruing to the labor factor, and even taking into account the fact that, well, if you work 24 hours a day for a few days in a row, you'd collapse. You know, even if we accounted for that, okay, you have to go to sleep, and you have to take breaks, and you have to eat and stuff like that to maintain your physical prowess, it's still the case that people, one way to look at it is, look, even a slave owner isn't going to literally make his slaves work 24 hours a day. That would be stupid, right? He doesn't make his horses work 24. If you own horses, you let them rest and you feed them and stuff, and if they're sick, you don't make them work, you let them recuperate and so on. So it's the same thing. Somebody who owned human slaves would also not literally try to wring 24 hours of labor out of them every day. But the point is, they would extract a lot more labor services from the slaves than the slaves would if they were freed and owned themselves. Okay, so that's where Mises and Rothbard are coming from when they say empirically, it seems like for most people, leisure is a consumer good. Okay, so that's what they have in mind. But I'm saying, I can imagine doing a praxeological analysis where you could probably get the main results of what we do when we study labor markets. Okay, moving on here. Okay, Crusoe economics. If you want, I think there's a, how can I put it? I did a pretty good simplified exposition of this in my textbook, Lessons for the Young Economist. Okay, so if you read this section in Man, Economy, and State and it was a little bit difficult for you, if you want to see the way I translated that for a much younger audience, then I would point you to the chapter in Lessons for the Young Economist, which, you know, you can get as a PDF. You don't have to buy it through the Mises Institute. And I have a whole chapter on Crusoe economics. And so I think I walked it through even a little bit more slowly than Rothbard does here, if this stuff interests you and you want to see it spelled out in greater detail. So for our purposes tonight, we're running low on time. Let me just run through some major things. So first of all, of course, the name comes from the fact that Robinson Crusoe was the, you know, fictional character who had a shipwreck and he's on a tropical island. And the idea is it's like the Tom Hanks movie Castaway is the modern day version of Robinson Crusoe, right? If you've seen that. Okay, so that so economists, when they were trying to explain from scratch the principles of economics, they would use Robinson Crusoe, because when they were writing back in the day, that was a familiar literary example to people. So it was a good illustration, whereas nowadays, a lot of people don't know what Robinson Crusoe is. All right, so nowadays you might call it, you know, Tom Hanks economics or something. So a lot, just so you know, a lot of critics of economics claimed that, oh, economists falsely believe that, you know, every man is an island and that they just engage in this atomistic exchange, and economists even have this unrealistic Robinson Crusoe economics and think that, you know, that they can adequately explain society by just focusing on one person, and that's crazy. All right, well, it's not that we're saying let's study this model of one person and then hope that it generalizes. Rather, it's saying the principles we're deriving for the one person, we then can apply to that person if he's in society, because the, you know, the principles are going to be very general. And then, yeah, the specific application might change if there's other people, but the point is you can learn a lot, and if you jump right into studying a society with 10 million people and money and stuff like that, you get overwhelmed. So we want to start slowly and just say, what can we say about one person operating in an environment where there's natural resources and the person has ends and scarce resources, and what does he do? You can learn a lot about basic economics from that, and then you start making it more and more complicated by adding more people. Okay. Specifically, the great virtue of Crusoe economics is you can see the benefits of saving and investment. So you can talk about economic categories like income and consumption, and then you can do things like, and Ropper goes through certain numerical examples. In my lessons for the young economist, I go through slightly different examples. I'm not going to go through them now if you just, because you can just read them. But what's going on there is you can say, look at Crusoe with his bare hands, his labor power, and given the raw natural resources at his disposal, he has a certain income that he can use his labor power to extract consumption every certain time period from the resources at his disposal, and that's his income. How much could he consume every day with the resources at his disposal? Now, if he wants to save, what does that mean? That means he consumes less than his income, and that gap is savings. And then if he invests, that means he takes his savings and devotes them to the production of things that he believes will augment his future income. Okay? So you can do things like say, oh, if in my textbook, for example, I got Crusoe can climb trees and collect coconuts, and he can get a certain amount per day if he, you know, leaves some of his time for sleeping. But if he consumes less than that, then he can start accumulating a stockpile of coconuts, and so he's saving. And then he can invest his labor power into producing a capital good, which might be a stick. So he goes around, you know, once he builds up an adequate stockpile of coconuts, he goes around, and instead of climbing trees and getting more coconuts, he just starts collecting sticks and vines, and then he ties the vines and the sticks together to make a sturdy pole. Okay, and then he can't do that until he's first saved up some coconuts, because he needs to eat while he's making the pole. Okay, so that's the function of the savings, is it bridges the gap while he's making the capital goods. And so what's the point of doing all that? Well, once he makes the capital good, he has this idea that I bet you my labor will be far more physically productive if I'm augmenting it with this capital good, something that I produced. Okay, so the pole isn't intrinsically useful to him. It's not that he's going to use it to scratch his back or something, the way that a coconut is a consumer good. The coconut directly satisfies his desire. You know, he's hungry. The coconut directly takes care of that. The pole he constructs is a capital good because it's only indirectly useful to him. It's a factor of production. With his labor power, that pole allows him to knock down a lot more coconuts per hour than if he just with his bare hands had to climb trees and grab the coconuts that way. Okay, so he's far, his labor's far more physically productive in terms of coconuts acquired per hour. And so that's why he values that capital good that he made. And so what happened there is because he saved and invested, his real income is higher. That if he asks himself, how many coconuts per day can I eat after I've engaged in this period of living below my means and accumulating coconuts and then investing in the production of a pole, now all of a sudden he can eat a lot more coconuts per day indefinitely. All right, so that's, you can see savings and investment and economic growth even with a one-person economy. That's the idea. Okay, a few remarks on capital, because this is very crucial to the Austrian view, and this underpins the Austrian theory of the business cycle. Right, and this is, for those of you who are aware of it, I mean, you might remember Paul Krugman in The Greatest Day of My Life, when he linked to me and said I was a moron, he linked to my article at Mises.org called The Importance of Capital Theory, where I spelled out the Austrian approach to the business cycle, and I said the single biggest problem with mainstream analysts and the reason they don't get what the Austrians are talking about is that the mainstream economists do not have an adequate theory of capital. They just look at aggregate demand and aggregate supply, and they don't realize there's a structure of production of capital goods that are all interlocked that yield, you know, the finished output goods, and they don't understand how during the boom that capital structure gets screwed up. And that is why. So anyway, here at this beginning stage, I just want to stress some things that Rothbard says that are exhibits of the Austrian approach to capital. Okay, so on page 52, he says, "He who possesses capital is that much further advanced in time on the road to the desired consumer's good." So what he means there is, remember, a capital good is something that humans produce. So if you didn't have capital goods, that wouldn't prevent you from ultimately getting those consumer goods. It would just mean before you could directly get the consumer good, you would have to first take the time to use your resources and your labor power and your time to produce the capital good, and then you could use the capital good to go ahead and produce the consumer's good. Okay, so if you had the capital good, then that's saving you time. Okay, and that's really important because the Austrian approach to capital and interest theory says that the reason we have interest is because of time preference, right? That you want to get stuff sooner rather than later. So that's the advantage of having capital goods. It's that it saves you time. It allows you to get the finished good sooner rather than later because you don't have to take the time to make the capital good. All right. He also stresses the importance of the maintenance of the capital stock, and that's what gross investment is. All right. And again, we'll later on in the course, well, in the book, I don't know if it's in this, that's probably not in this first section. We go through specific numerical examples and you'll see, but the idea is once you build capital goods, you have to maintain them if you don't want your real income to fall back down to the level it was before. So when Crusoe builds that pole that allows him to knock down coconuts, he has to occasionally, you know, mend the pole. He has to set time aside each week or whatever to maybe go get new vines and retie the pole, the sticks, and then if the, you know, sticks start really getting withered, he might have to go and build a whole new pole from scratch, that kind of thing. So if he ever is lax and just keeps using the pole each day and eats all the coconuts that he's getting with it without, in a sense, reinvesting in the capital stock, then at some point, you know, he's going to whack a coconut and the pole's going to snap in two, and then he's going to be back to where he started originally. All he's going to have is his bare hands, and his standard of living is going to crash. Okay, and so that's called capital consumption. If you're not engaging in enough gross investment to at least maintain your capital stock, then effectively you're what's called consuming capital. So you can literally do that if you're a farmer and you have the seed corn. Okay, so you plant the corn and you harvest the corn every harvest season, and then you're supposed to set aside some of the corn to replant for next year, the seed corn. But if you didn't do that, you ate all the other corn, and then you said, you know what, I'm really hungry, I'm going to eat the seed corn too. Well, then your consumption is higher that period. You're eating more corn, and that's good. It satisfies your hunger. But then next year, no corn's going to shoot out of the ground because you ate all the seed corn. So there, you're literally eating your capital, consuming your capital. But you can also metaphorically do it. You know, in the example I just gave you with Crusoe, it's not that he's going to start gnawing on the pole, but the point is, if he doesn't account for the fact that the pole is physically degrading over time, then in a sense, part of his consumption every day, part of the coconuts he's eating, isn't because his real income is that high. It's because he's, you know, eating away at the value of that pole, if you will. Okay, because he ought to be devoting some of his labor time to maintaining the pole, and if instead he's using it to get more coconuts per day, then yeah, his consumption's higher than it otherwise would be. He's getting to eat more coconuts, but at the expense of the degradation of his capital stock. And so that would be called capital consumption. So this is what the Austrians think happens during an unsustainable boom. So during the housing bubble years, when Paul Krugman and other people were saying, oh, this is great, look at how high real GDP is, and now that real GDP has crashed, gee, the government ought to stimulate spending because we know physically we can have output as high as it was in 2007. Well, the Austrians say, no, the reason output seemed to be so high is that we were consuming our capital, that wasn't sustainable. Okay, and you can't even get the Austrian point if you don't understand their approach to capital theory. Okay, I think I got two more slides. I'll rush through those since we're over time here. Okay, as far as costs, so the definition, the cost of an action is the subjective value or the utility that the actor places on the next best alternative that cannot be achieved because of the action. All right, and so an implication of that is the costs really can't be realized. They're always just anticipated or estimated. Right, so the example I like to give, a woman who has several suitors, guys who are trying to, you know, win her hand in marriage, and then she finally chooses one and says, okay, I'm going to marry Bill. I'm going to marry bachelor number two. And you say, what's the cost of her choice? Well, it's not the amount of money she spends on the wedding cake and how much she spends on the gown and stuff like that. That's not really the cost. The cost of the choice of choosing Bill is the value she places on what was her next best option. If you said to her, okay, you know, Bill's off the table now, you can't choose to marry him, what do you want to do? If she said, oh, well, in that case, I would marry Sam, then the subjective happiness in her mind of a life spent after she chooses to marry Sam is the cost of her decision to marry Bill. We're ruling out polygamy, okay? Or if she said, well, no, if I couldn't marry Bill, I would just remain unmarried and I would go get, you know, I'd go work in the Peace Corps or something, then that would be the cost of marrying Bill, is the, you know, the life she could have had she not married him. Okay, so you can see there, strictly speaking, she can never know what the actual cost was, because she doesn't really know how life would have been had she not married Bill. Okay, I mean, she can have a conjecture, and if Bill turns out to, you know, be an alcoholic and cheating on her all the time, she might think, I really wish I hadn't married Bill. I would have been happier had I chosen otherwise. But strictly speaking, she can't just look at the world and know that she would have been happy otherwise. Okay, because she didn't go down that alternate timeline. Okay, last slide, right? Last one. Okay, in the appendix, Wofford actually does spell out the difference between praxeology and economics and catalactics. So he does do it a certain way. Like I said, I think in various places in Human Action, Mises bounces around a little bit, but at least here, Wofford defines things a certain way that's consistent. So praxeology is the formal study of the fact that people use means to achieve ends. but we don't care about what the ends are. Okay, so we're not, so praxeology works, is applicable to Mother Teresa and to Hannibal Lecter. That we just say, oh, Mother Teresa, her goal is to help poor children in underdeveloped countries, and so she chooses means to achieve those ends. She, you know, writes op-eds to the New York Times and to London newspapers asking people to donate to her charity. She goes out and buys penicillin and blah, blah, blah. Hannibal Lecter's goal is to go eat people, and so he says, okay, well, what do I want to do? Well, I have to evade the police. I have to, get this guy to come over to my house. I have to go get the, what do you call that? I forget the stuff you use to knock people out that he puts in his handkerchief. It's escaped me. I don't typically try to knock people out so I can eat them, so I don't know how you do it. But anyway, you get the point that economics is not about selfish people who are trying to get rich. Okay, that's a caricature. It's true that may have applied to certain types of economics, but certainly not to Austrian economics or praxeology. Okay, so praxeology does not assume that people are selfish. It can assume that people are self-interested in the sense that they want to achieve their ends, but those ends could be completely altruistic. Right? So you can explain any motivated, purposeful action with praxeology. Okay, so now economics is a subset of praxeology, and Rothbard says economics studies two things. On the one hand, the isolated individual, so that's Robinson Crusoe economics, and then interpersonal exchange, which is also known as catalactics. Okay, so if you look at that, you'll see what it's excluding is interpersonal action that cannot be classified as exchange. All right, so if you just got one person and then the natural environment, that's Robinson Crusoe economics. It could be Hannibal Lecter or it could be Mother Teresa. If they're isolated, it's just Robinson Crusoe economics, okay? Because you can't, you can't violate property rights if you own everything, if you're the only person. But once you have more than one person, now you can act, but what you're doing might not fall under the framework of an interpersonal exchange, because interpersonal exchange implies that there's property rights and it's voluntary. So if you just go up to somebody and punch him in the face and take his tomatoes, that's action. That falls under praxeology, but it's not under economics, or at least not free market economics, okay? Because that's not interpersonal exchange. It's violence and theft. Okay, so why don't I now turn it over to your questions? I went a little bit over there, but I think everything we covered was pretty important. Okay, and I timed out, of course, so let me log back in. Okay. Okay, Naju has a claim about the convertibility, but he has a specific numerical example, so I think I better not do that now, because otherwise I'll have to get lost in his example. Let's see. Da-da-da-da. Okay, Louis, or Luis, I'm not sure how you pronounce your name, probably Luis, says, in sailing through the final pages of Chapter 1, specifically on the formation of capital, I was kind of confused by the theoretical distinction between plane saving and capitalist saving. I realize, as Rothbard clearly points out, that the difference between both kinds of saving is actually very slight, and by implication, they both pursue the maturity of consumers' goods over time, thus reaching a higher value. When further analyzing the subject, I keep wondering, does capitalist saving necessarily imply the allocation of certain goods to the physical act of transformation into gradually lower stages? Okay, I'm just going to skim this and then paraphrase. It's a long question. Okay, so I think he's just asking for me to elaborate on the difference between plain saving and capitalist saving. So I'm not, I think I'm just reiterating what Rothbard said, that, yeah, I mean, the distinction means on plain saving, you are just building up a stockpile of the finished consumer good. Whereas with capitalist saving, you are, you're living below your means, because that's what savings is. It's when your consumption is less than your income. But the savings does not consist of the accumulation of consumer goods. It's that you channel it into something else, specifically the production of capital goods. Okay, so with Crusoe, if he's going around and he can collect 10 coconuts a day with his bare hands, right? He's starting out, he has no capital goods. He can, with his bare hands and the trees and stuff at his disposal, he can collect 10 coconuts a day. So we'd say his income, his real income, if you will, is 10 coconuts per day. So he could consume up to 10 coconuts per day. Suppose he only consumes 8 per day for a while. So that means every day he's saving 2 coconuts. And if he engages in plain saving, that means he just starts accumulating them. The first day he has 2, the second day he has 4, and so on. Also, incidentally, everyone realize, if you're worried about the coconuts getting old and spoiled, he can, when he eats 8 per day, he can be eating the oldest 8 in his stockpile. Okay, so once he builds up a stockpile, you know, he can always eat the oldest 8 that he owns, and then the new 8 that he picks that day, he just adds to like the right-hand side of the stockpile. Okay, so that way he keeps the, you know, the average age of the coconuts in his inventory is as low as possible. Okay, so he doesn't have to actually eat the stuff he picks that day. Okay, but if he engages in capitalist saving, the point is he's still living below his means. He's consuming less than what his income is. He's consuming fewer coconuts than he would be physically able to get. But what he's doing with that extra income is channeling it into the accumulation of capital goods, as opposed to just increasing the stocks of consumer goods. So if he's going around and using his labor power to make the stick, the point is dependent, you know, you could try to value it and say, well, what is he doing there? And it's, if he's only, again, eating 8 coconuts per day, you could say, well, he's still saving. Right, he's living, you know, he's consuming less than his means, and the way you know, it gets a little bit tricky, because how do you value the stick in terms of coconuts? But that's the idea, okay, that he's still consuming less, so he's, you know, directing his stuff to the future, but the form of that saving, you know, that, and that's kind of the distinction between investment as well. Right, so I don't know if I'm answering your question fully, but that is the distinction. And you're right, as Rothbard points out, that at one level, they're both the same kind of thing. That whether you're, in a sense, investing in the accumulation of more coconuts, or whether you're investing in the production of a pole, the motivation for both is so that you can consume more coconuts in the future. That's why you're doing it. But that's why they're both called savings. And strictly speaking, you could call both investment if you wanted to. You could say, I'm investing in the accumulation of coconuts, if you wanted to talk like that. Right? But some people might say, well, that's not really investment, or that's not the same kind of investment. So it depends really how you want to classify it. But you're right. If you personally kind of think that distinction is a little bit arbitrary, nothing's going to blow up if you just say, no, everything is capitalist saving. And someone who is accumulating coconuts, I'm going to classify those coconuts as a second order good. That they are, you know, a factor of production that might then turn into a consumer good if I decide to eat them. I mean, you could do it that way if you wanted to. There'd be nothing wrong in doing that. It just might sound a little bit clunky. Okay. Graham Wright says, Rothbard stresses in footnote 27 that his statement that leisure is preferred over labor is an empirical observation. However, if a man claims to prefer labor over leisure, then surely from his own perspective, his labor is leisure. Because to say that you prefer labor over leisure is to say that you would continue to perform the action even if you were deprived of the final product. But as Rothbard later says, those activities which are engaged in purely for their own sake are not labor, but are pure play, consumers' goods in themselves. So if someone claiming to prefer labor over leisure is really just making a category error. So why did Rothbard call his statement that leisure is preferred over labor an empirical assumption? Is this not implied by the very definitions of labor and leisure? Right. Okay. So Graham, I'm glad then that I went on that little digression, because you're right. I think that if you really push it and you say, what do we mean in terms of the definitions of leisure and labor, it almost does look like by definition people have to prefer leisure over labor, because if they didn't, then what we are calling labor would be leisure, right? So I'm sympathetic to what you're saying, and I think you could adequately explain everything in labor markets using that analysis and not stipulating that there's this extra thing that we need to assume that leisure is a consumer good. Because another way that I've tried to illustrate this, and I really should at some point write this up, because it's, you know, whether or not it's right, I think I can make a convincing argument for the position. So if it's wrong, it's worth me writing it up and someone blowing me up. But, you know, what if somebody owns forest, you know, a wilderness area where there's, you know, Bambi's frolicking with his mother and Thumper and all that stuff, and then somebody comes along and wants to clear cut it and put up a shopping mall, you can imagine that the owner of that forest, you know, the virgin forest that has never been developed by human hands, might, other things equal, say, nah, that would kind of bother me. I don't want to develop that. Now, if the shopping mall developer offered enough money, eventually you might say, okay, yeah, sure. You know, I'll set the fire and get Bambi out of there myself. Give me that money. But the point is, you can imagine things that are analogous to human beings not selling every last minute of labor power to get the most money for it. You can imagine resource owners of other types of resources doing that too, something that's analogous to that they actually don't sell every last unit just to maximize the monetary returns to that factor, that some of them might choose to leave some units, you know, unused, the way that we don't labor all the time with our bodies. Okay, so, and you might say that's an empirical observation, that we can imagine a world where people who own the forest don't care about it, but it seems in our world that a lot of owners do have a preference for not allocating every last square inch of land to productive uses instead of keeping it fallow. Okay, so I think I'm sympathetic to you, and at the very least, I think one could make a plausible argument that we don't need to be, there's nothing empirical about this, that you just had the categories of leisure and labor defined praxeologically, and then that's all you need. And then, of course, for a specific illustration, you can fill it in with realistic assumptions, just like you can talk about a ham sandwich, but it's not that action and the notion of lower order consumer goods requires that people have hunger and eat ham sandwiches. That's just a particular illustration. Okay, let me answer one more, and then we'll stop. Let's see. Jacob Champness says, wouldn't it be correct to say that successive units of a good are used to satisfy ends of lesser or equal urgency? If so, wouldn't it be more correctly described as the law of non-increasing marginal utility? Well, for sure, if your premise were true, then yes, it would be the law of non-increasing marginal utility. as opposed to the law of diminishing marginal utility. But I think Rothbard would say that no, it praxeologically it doesn't make sense. You can't have two ends that are of equal urgency, because as I get more and more units of a good, I devote them to various ends. So I get the first unit, I devote it to the most important end. I get the second unit, I devote it to the second most. And so I think your idea is, well, okay, maybe after the fourth unit, now it's the fifth unit, and my fifth, and I have a tie between, you know, so two different ends are tied for fifth place, is the fifth most important end that can be satisfied with this type of good. Rothbard's going to say, no, when I give you that fifth unit, you're going to use it to satisfy one end or the other, and whichever one you choose, by definition, that's the thing, that end is more important to you than the one that you didn't choose. That's all we mean praxeologically when we say something is more important to you than something else. That if faced with a choice between the two, you choose the one over the other. And, you know, maybe psychologically you flip the coin or something, and maybe in your mind, well, I just had to choose, and I picked one of them, I don't really care. But there, you see, we're delving into your mind and trying to figure out why did you rank things a certain way. But from your action, the fact that you took that fifth unit and devoted it to this end and not the other end means that first end is higher on your scale of values than the thing that you didn't satisfy. And so, by definition, it had more importance to you than the thing that you chose not to satisfy. So it had a higher utility than the thing that you're now going to satisfy with the sixth unit. Okay, so that's what how I think Rothbard would answer you. Because remember, we're not saying that as praxeologists, we're not saying that the successive units of goods are giving you a certain amount of psychic happiness that, you know, a certain amount of utils that we can't really measure but we know are there, and then we're just kind of backing out and saying, you know, so strictly speaking, it for the purposes of action, it doesn't make sense to say that you are indifferent between two things. All right, so we'll get to that at some point. I don't know if we get to it in this course, but in Man, Economy, and State, Rothbard rejects the neoclassical notion of indifference. He's saying that he'll say, yeah, psychologically, we could say that you're indifferent between these two things, but in action, you have to choose. And the thing you choose, you just demonstrated that you preferred that over the other thing. And as economists, as practitioners, we don't care why you did it. You know, if you choose steak over hamburger, then that means you valued the steak more than the hamburger. It was higher on your scale of values. I don't really care if you tell me, oh, no, it's because the steak tastes good, or if you tell me, well, because I thought that the hamburger was made with unfair labor practice, so I'm boycotting it. I don't care why you did it. The fact is you did do it, that you chose one over the other, and so it must be higher on your value scale. That's all it means to say it's higher on your value scale, because that's the idea. Okay, well, why don't we stop there? And again, I will, I have been tardy. I apologize. I still have to catch up on the week one questions, but I will get all caught up to speed. And remember, if you're taking the class for credit, you will, the quiz for this week is going to get posted early Friday, and you'll have the normal time frame to answer that. Okay, so long, everybody.